This is an interview between David Robinson of Positive Feedback Online with David Chesky of Chesky Records and HD Tracks, June 7, 2010. David, I'll get a greeting from you as a level check, please.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, looks good. Okay, so we're set. David, I wanted to first off thank you for taking some time with me so that we could be sharing more about you and what you're doing with the readers of Positive Feedback Online. First off, I wanted to start with your background. You've been with Chesky Records, of course, from the very beginning as one of the people who established it. But before that, I know that your involvement in music was deep. Tell us a little bit about how you first became interested in music and then composing.
Well, I was interested in music since I'm a child. I mean, you know, I always loved music, wanted to do music when I was in elementary school. Before then, I learned how to play the piano. By the time I was in junior high school, I had my own bands, jazz groups, rock bands. And when I left high school, you know, I just came to New York and wanted to be a musician. That was it. And I studied here, and I worked a lot in studios, and was a studio orchestrator and conductor for a lot of TV and movies way back then. And I also had a big band. We played at the Village Vanguard, Storyville, and JVC Jazz Festivals. Mm-hmm. And then I got interested in classical music. So music is just what I do. Mm-hmm. Recording happens to be an offshoot of music, because if you're going to record, you record music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds very familiar, because I became interested in audio really early on in my life and recording myself. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was buying my first open reel machine and recording friends who had bands going. There's a tremendous relationship between love of music and performance and recording. I mean, they just seem to go together naturally. Now, you mentioned all these groups that you did. What sort of musical instruments were you playing at this time?
Piano. I'm a pianist.
Okay, so keyboards. Cool. Now, composing is an aspect of your career that I followed actually with some interest, because you went beyond the simple and obvious sort of things, songwriting,
right,
to actually composing major orchestral works, something that Paul McCartney has tried his hand at from time to time, and in my opinion, not as successfully as you did. How did you get involved in composing all the way up to the level of orchestral music?
Well, I studied to be an orchestrator when I was young. And when I was young, you know, like 18 or 19, I made my living in New York as an orchestrator. So I really come from that world of commercial orchestration when they had TV shows. So I would work in London and New York in studios doing orchestral music, so I feel very comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And, what I'm trying to do is this. You know, the music we hear in most American concert halls is about 175-year comfort period. And it's music that was written 6,000 miles away about 200 years ago for a king. So as good as the music is, it's not relevant to our context. You know, art, in art, you have to have context.
Yes, exactly.
So what I'm trying to do is take the sound around me, which is jazz, Latin, hip-hop, whatever you have in New York City, and use these as the building blocks for my orchestral music. Just like Stravinsky would use Russian peasant songs, and Bartok would use, you know, peasant songs from Hungary. That was their popular culture, and they used it. And that's what made it great, because it was organic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm trying to synthesize the world I live in and mm-hmm. create this new type of orchestral music, which I call urban, because I don't live on a farm in the suburbs, uh-huh. and I live in the middle of New York City,
uh-huh.
so
uh-huh.
I write music like that, so I try to reflect my environment, my culture.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that actually brings to mind wonderful people like Gershwin, of course, who actually broke through a massive barriers.
Well, when you listen to what makes Gershwin great is because there's an organic aspect to his music. You close your eyes, you feel, you smell New York City.
Exactly.
And it had context. It was putting up a mirror to New York in, mm-hmm. When he was writing music in the 30s, back
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that's what made it great, and it has the staying power. It has, you know, it's sort of like, I'll give you an analogy. It's like audio. It's when you hear a high-end system, there's a three-dimensionality, palpability, coherency to it that makes it great. And if when the audio is not great, it sounds like little stick paper figures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no solidity mm-hmm. to the image. And it's the same thing in music. I find the organic writers
mm-hmm.
and that take the organic concepts and refine them as building blocks, it's a much stronger work of art, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, it doesn't suffer from being derivative, which
right.
is the kiss of death in art.
Right. And I find many things today are just, you know, variations of a theme, and there's literally no philosophical grounding for the work to even exist. It's like
mm-hmm.
an intellectual exercise.
Right, and that's why I found your compositional work to be really intriguing, because you've gone off in some interesting directions in these orchestral pieces that you've done. They're not always pretty or pleasant. It's not plastic. It really feels like it comes from the soul. It's complex, and I find some of your work extremely contemplative. I just sit back and the images form in your mind. So I really appreciate the organic that you're speaking of in your own work. So essentially, your background then is deeply involved and immersed in all aspects of music composition, the musical arts. My question then is, you've talked about this connection between music and audio. How did you make the transition to decide to form Chesky Records? How did that come about?
Young, I lived in a recording studio, and I was fascinated with audio. It was fun, you know. You would record, you'd mix, you know. I was just a conductor and an arranger. I wasn't a producer then, but I learned, and I would sit there, and I was just fascinated. So I learned as much as I could, and then one day, you know, I always wanted to start a record company. And one day I was sitting there on the podium and saying, you know, where I stand conducting, it sounds fantastic. And they had like 50 microphones up, and when you hear it and they have to put it together, it didn't sound so good. So I said, you know, it would be nice to start a label from a conductor's perspective. And that's how we got the idea to do the, you know, simple miking in the early, when we started, it was just simple blue mine technique,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
one blue mine microphone, and that's how we captured it. For better or worse,
mm-hmm.
that was the perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
then I became an audiophile, and then I, you know, wanted to make things simpler and simpler, and the circuit simpler. And, you know, one thing fed off another. Listen, if you're going to spend all day in the studio, you might as well take a little extra time and do it right, because it's there forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that actually sets you apart, because I have a number of friends who are jazz musicians, who are rock and rollers, and others. And I'm amazed at how many really terrible audio systems that musicians own. I mean, it's almost like they can hear it. They experience the music so directly anyway that almost anything is good enough for them to be enjoying what's going on, which, as we all know, can be part of the curse of being an audiophile, is you start niggling the sound and noodling everything, and the next thing you know is not enjoying the music anymore.
Well, you know, that's true, but I find when you really hit it right, all of a sudden, the audio aspect goes away, and you really get deep into the music.
Yeah.
You know. Let's look at it like this. You know, this is how I do the analogy with HD tracks, but it applies to audio. If someone has a Stradivarius, it might as well sound like a Stradivarius. You know, the tone of an instrument is the poetry that moves us. I can pick up a score and read it. I don't have to even hear it to just hear it in my head. But when it's realized, it's that tone. You know, musicians, whether it's a saxophone player or a tenor sax, he spends his whole life to get his tone. Sonny Rollins, Dexter Gordon, you know, you hear the tone of the person. And it's the same thing with the great violinist. So the better your system is, if you can really capture the tone, you really hear the poetry of what the art is about.
Well, and that's what allows the emotional connection for me. I think that transforming moment comes when you realize that a really good listening room with a fine system is almost like a musical instrument itself. and it can reperform great recordings in such a way that you're actually able to connect at an emotional and spiritual level with music. And of course, that changes everything.
Sure, and then you can hit it and hear it again and again and again.
Exactly.
Anytime you want, that's the great thing. And look, the music I want to listen to, I can't go to a concert hall and hear it because, you know, it's not programmed.
Right, exactly. You know? Exactly. Well, and there's that the massive joy you get when you get to share it with somebody else too.
Mm-hmm.
When you bring a friend in who has their life transformed. I mean, I've been the person who has introduced some good friends of mine to people like Gershwin. I mean, it's amazing when you realize there are people who've never heard Gershwin before.
Right.
And when they hear Gershwin done right, then literally I've had people in tears in my listening room, and that's great. That's one of the reasons why you do it, just for the joy of sharing that kind of emotional connection. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. You established Chesky Records then with this conductor's perspective that you wanted to share. Were you doing a lot of original recordings at the beginning?
What do you mean, with the label?
Yeah, with the label itself. I mean,
well, with the label, we started off with reissues.
Uh-huh.
Here's how we started the label. You know, I was a composer, and I wrote a piano concerto.
Uh-huh.
And my uncle was friendly with another person who was very good friends with Earl Wild, so he introduced me. And Earl would help me with my piano concerto. I was uh-huh. young at the time. And then I bought these old reissues of the Rachmaninoffs that Earl
uh-huh.
did.
Oh, yeah, I've got that recording. It's brilliant.
And they're on a budget label.
Uh-huh.
So it didn't sound great, but the more I started reading about Kenneth Wilkinson and Charles Gerhardt, I said to myself, you know, these are supposed to be like the greatest producing team and recording team in the world. I mean, they're legendary for the Deccas and all this. Why does it sound? It sounds so bad, right?
Uh-huh.
So I said to Earl, you know, why don't we go to the RCA vaults one day and just pull out the master tape and hear it?
Uh-huh.
So Earl arranged it. And we did, and it was phenomenal. And I said, you know something, why don't we take these and really reissue these the way they should be? So we recut these, and then we put them out on, you know, the Virgin 188 gram vinyl.
Yep.
And that's how we started the label, with the Rachmaninoff Concerto number 2.
Yep, I've got that. It's absolutely delicious. Matter of fact, I had never heard of Earl Wild before, and I came away from listening to that with an immense respect for him. What a brilliant pianist.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that's actually then how you started. What did you have to do? Did you have to have inside connections to do the reissues? Were you able to build some momentum and then start knocking on other doors? How did you build the label?
We built the label by reissuing that in the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the CES show at the Chicago in the summer at the Blackstone Hotel, and we started giving them out to people. We met dealers. And that's how we started, knocking on doors.
Uh-huh.
And those were successful, we put out another one.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And we worked our way up to RCA's.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, we started the jazz division, which we started with the Blumlein microphone. And Johnny Frigo and Bucky Pizzarelli live at Studio A was our first
uh-huh.
recording.
I remember that one. I've got that. That's a great recording. And boy, to listen to Pizzarelli and say, I tell you, that's a style of guitar that you don't hear much.
Right.
I mean,
and you know, John, his son, that was, you know, one of his first records, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he was just a sideman on there.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And he was absolutely knockout. I listened to that and I thought, you know, you would recognize that if you were listening in the 30s and 40s, where that style of guitar was really common. Nowadays, I think you'd only find a handful of people who could fret that quickly. I mean, to switch from chord to chord as quickly as he did. And with such fluidity. I mean, I play guitar myself, and I'm just sitting there saying, wow, that's absolutely tremendous. Tremendous to listen to, and it was a great recording. A lot of joy in that album. So you guys worked your way up then by knocking on doors and issuing good reissues to the point where you're issuing your own recordings at that time.
Right.
I've got a pile of your LPs and CDs I've bought over the years, And I know that, good grief, when did you guys start? I'm trying to remember the exact year you started to launch those.
86 or 87?
That sounds about right. Because I was picking you guys up through Chad Cassell.
Right.
Chad's probably responsible for the destruction of more people's wallets than you could shake a stick at.
Well, you know, Chad started pretty much with us. I mean, he was one of our first customers.
Yeah.
He called us up. He was working out of his house at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was shortly after that that I connected with Chad, and I started, because I had graduated from my mid-fi days into high-end at that time, and I had come across him. I think, you know, I was reading Stereophile and TASS and doing the usual stuff, and I came across him, and it was through him that I connected with what you were doing there. I mean, I started buying what you guys were doing. So you were clearly doing terrific stuff, and some of the RCA reissues, that's long before other companies started playing with the RCAs. And that was my first exposure to some of what that great stuff was. Interestingly enough, when I was a kid, heck, I grew up with the RCAs and with the Mercs. My dad had a whole pile of them around. So for me, it was actually very normal to be listening to Shaded Dogs and Mercuries, because they were part of our household. So we wore out a lot of those albums. Okay, well, let's turn the page here for a second. You established that in the late 80s, Chesky Records was there, and you worked your way up through the LPs and the CDs. At what point did you become interested in higher res on the digital side, and how did you approach that?
From day one, I was interested in higher res on any side. That's how we mastered the records, and we had special cables made and everything. I mean, this is what we were fanatics. But from day one, when we first started our label, we didn't record with a normal A to D converter. We started with 128 oversampling. We were the first people to do this. Mm-hmm. And we got these boards, and we just had someone make us, George K. I'm not even sure it was George back then, our first 128 times oversampling 44.1 A to D converter. Mm-hmm. And this way we could, you know, actually record much higher and do the filtering higher in the DAC. Mm-hmm. And then convert down, so we had a much better, you know, sound quality. And then the time went along, we got a 96 kilohertz DAC. We were the first people to get that. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that happened, we were the first people to put out 9624 recordings. Mm-hmm. On the DVD video spec. And mm-hmm. then we made DVD audio. Mm-hmm. And as soon as SACD happened, we were right there doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I ended up moving with you all the way along. I have samples in our reference library here of all the steps that you took along the way, and I can remember being impressed with each step forward. Unfortunately, some of the confusion about the higher res formats and the format wars that erupted in the late 90s and early 2010s were really troublesome. How did you guys deal with the fact that they were both out there? Did you end up having to juggle the two for a while until you saw it settled out, or what did you do?
You mean DVD audio and SACD?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we had to juggle it. We got stuck in the middle of a format war.
Mm-hmm.
That's still unresolved.
Yeah. Well, and it's really unusual. I mean, I won't go into all of the politics that happened there. You really wish that the large labels would try to come to agreement on important things like this, so that we wouldn't end up tossed and turned with having to support a bunch of different formats, or have people lose when it comes to investing in one or the other. Now, Universal players make it a lot easier to deal with that, of course.
Right.
But from the beginning, I actually got invited down to MoFi to sit in on some of the, sit in on the very first demo to the audio press of the DSD system that they had. At the time, I was intensely investigating 9624. Hadn't even heard of DSD. And, I sure came away impressed when I spent time there. I thought, man, that's really something. So you guys supported both formats, and you're continuing to issue SACDs, and they continue to be excellent. There's a lot of this is, of course, having to deal with market realities, but just purely on the aesthetic side, what's your take in passing on DSD and SACD as far as quality goes?
On DSD and SACD?
Mm-hmm.
Complicated because SACD and DSD is one large loop, as you say. You know, you record DSD, it's good to release it on SACD, and everything's built in. I can't get into all the technical reasons, but think of it as one continuous thing.
Uh-huh.
However, the web is a PCM format,
right?
So we're doing everything on the web now in PCM, and when we get an SACD in, we have to convert it back to PCM.
Right, exactly. Well, that's one of the things that has been both a huge strength and, of course, something of a difficulty with the internet, because everything being built PCM in the world of computing, it's made things really easy for distribution, but of course it's also made things really easy to pirate and a whole bunch of other problems that the music biz has wrestled with. Well, anyway, if we shift back to the question of PCM and downloadable, that brings us directly to HD tracks.
Right.
And that's been something that the music biz has been growing and developing here. Obviously, iTunes and Amazon's downloadable MP3s and so forth have pointed the way. Last time I checked, iTunes was up to about 28% of the market share. And I think Amazon was second at 8 to 10% market share. So clearly this is the trend. People are voting for it. How are you guys approaching this challenge? What's HD?
Well, to me, two things. I think, let's go about it this way. Let's forget the challenge. Let's talk about just the quality. I think digital's gotten a bad rap because not about the digital, but it's sort of like in the old days, vinyl had a lot more information on it than you can get off a disc.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same thing with digital. The problem with digital is the physical silver disc. It's the interface. It's the jitter. It's the error correction,
mm-hmm.
getting the information off the disc that I think that messes up digital.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, we're off of this 44.1 standard, which has the inherent jitter and error correction. And all of a sudden, we're getting to play a file back from RAM, not even off a disc anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So look at all of these problems have been solved, and we can get this jitter way down, and you can hear the file, and not only we can play back 44.1, but it's also at 9624. So I think it can give audio a giant leap forward, so you can hear how good digital can actually sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I definitely agree with you on that. I think that the optical interface and some of the electromechanical aspects of optical playback have been pretty tough to overcome. And so the jitter question, especially when we went two box with digital playback and so forth, got pretty ornate. As a matter of fact, when I was examining 9624 in the later 90s, you remember some of the chains you'd build up, man. You had all sorts of special devices and link locks and everything else. I'd get to the point where I'd actually lose synchronization because I had so many devices plugged together, going from this to that to the other thing, and it would get to the point where it simply wouldn't function anymore. So it's good to get rid of all of the complexities that allow us to get as close to the source as possible. I've gotten to hear DSD masters and high-resolution PCM masters in the studio. I know how good they are, because they really can be good. It's just that getting them out there, distributing them with any reasonable degree of fidelity has been the problem. Tim DePeravicini once told me that, he said, David, the problem is not recording, the problem is playback. He said, we can record. He says, it's amazing how much tapes out of the early 50s have on them, but to get them to play back correctly, he says, that's the trick. And so I agree with you. Playback is huge. Now, do you see then with the arrival of being able to play our music files back from RAM that this has pretty much solved this? How far along do you think we are?
Well, I don't know how far along, but all I know is that, I mean, they're really working hard on getting this jitter down to like practically nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. And at least it's opened our eyes and said, you know, hey, you know, door number one is not working. We're going to go to door number two. And wow, look at this big improvement here. Now we know this works. We could refine this even more. And perhaps we'll go to 192.24.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we'll do multi-channel, you know, mm-hmm. high mm-hmm. resolution, which we have here. And we can play back multi-channel 192.24 in our studio. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I think by getting rid of this, you know, bumblebee effect in there, it just makes everything purer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. No, I would definitely agree with you on that. We're getting to hear, we've got some playback equipment here under review that's allowing us to hear 176.4 mm-hmm. and 192.24.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality is really quite remarkable. We're actually doing things now that we couldn't have even dreamed of even 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the quality of PCM playback is via RAM is certainly improved tremendously.
Sure.
And
now these programs, I mean, a lot of these music servers, even though it plays it from a hard disk, it takes the data and loads it into RAM
mm-hmm.
and then spits it out, you know. And mm-hmm. perhaps the next guy is going to rebuffer, you know, mm-hmm. 15 times and clean mm-hmm. it up and even make it better.
Exactly. Well, just the fact that I can sit here and I've got a high-end Dell workstation
mm-hmm.
that I do my playback on that can handle the 9624s very nicely. And I listen to these downloads that I've been getting from HD Tracks, and they're absolutely fantastic. They sound terrific. I'm using Winamp myself for the playback of the FLAC files.
Right.
And absolutely no problem whatsoever under Vista. So, I mean, that's been the smooth solution, and it's a free download. You can get the basic Winamp player, which has great functionality for no charge. You just download it, install it, and go. So the quality of the work that you're doing there from the samples that we've been able to download and check has been terrific. I've downloaded various kinds of music, and every genre is sounding terrific coming from HD Tracks. So let's talk for a second about business model. You love music, I love music, we both love audio, etc. But then there comes the question of, okay, so how do we make any money at this? So with HD Tracks, without going into anything proprietary, what's the general logic that you're using to approach this business?
Well, the logic is predicated on one thing. There only needs to be two stores in the world, iTunes and HD Tracks. Anything in the world you want to buy, you can buy it from iTunes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for those who want liner notes in high resolution at 4,608 kilobits per second, there's HD Tracks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's it. My motto is the same motto I had with the record company. Look, there's Sony and there's Warner Brothers and there's Chesky. We're always going to be a niche thing, but we're here to do quality. I mean, we make Ferraris and Bentleys, and that's our customer base.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a very definite niche. I think a lot of the big music biz companies have gone to the ultra-compressed, mashed-up stuff and just seek to sell a lot of units of whatever it is people want to download one at a time. And while some of the MP3 or Apple lossless, one of the AACs, have okay quality for carry along in the airport, when it comes to actually sitting down and listening to music, I mean, it just doesn't cut it. And so I think there will always be a niche that is interested in quality in any area. But in music, I mean, that's particularly so. Let's take a look for a second at the labels that you've been able to get aboard. How many labels does HD Trax currently servicing?
I don't know. Well over 100, I think.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And we have some majors on there now. You know, we have Verve, yep. We have Universal, we have the Concord Music, Telarc Fantasy, all these people are joining on now.
Yeah, I noticed that one of my favorite classical labels, BIS, is there too.
Right, and then we have ECM.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think people who are, you know, quality conscious are interested in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, do you have any problems getting labels aboard? I mean, we've talked earlier about knocking and going door to door and trying to get people to understand what it is that HD Trax represents.
They want to be on now, because HD Trax is artist-driven. Artists hear of it and say, listen, let's forget the audiophile thing for a second. Let's say you're a rock and roll band and you spend 8 months in a studio working hard on your album. The arena that you want your music to be heard on is not going to be $2 plastic speakers while you're surfing the net web.
Uh-huh.
These guys made it so you can put it on a big pair of speakers and crank it up to 11 and listen to it.
Yeah.
So these are the people that are driving and saying, hey, we want an outlet so people can really hear what we're doing for those who want it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So they're causing the labels to pick up the phone and say, so-and-so wants his record up and so, and that's how we get these deals.
Okay, artist-driven. Oh, that's extremely cool in the first place. Anything that comes from the artist side, I tend to trust an awful lot more than what tends to come from bean counters. So if the artists are driving it, then that would explain why you've got so many labels aboard. I noticed that as I've looked through your labels, you've got, for example, in the BIS section, which I've looked at, you've got a tremendous number of recordings there. In others, it's obvious that things are still getting up to speed. Are you finding that some labels are much more interested or more motivated and others not so much, or is it just a question of getting up to speed?
It's very difficult also because our labels are not really up to speed on delivering high-risk content. We have to hold our hands and help them on this. But it's just a learning curve.
Okay.
You know? And also, you know, most labels are very mass market-oriented.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they're not interested in niche products. But I think as the, you know, market collapses in music, you know, people need these niche markets.
Uh-huh. I agree. Well, it's music distribution seems to be atomizing, actually. It's no longer, the big labels no longer control it, which is, I think, part of the problem. We'll get to that a little later in our conversation. But it's definitely no longer the control factor that used to be there. Do you have any sense right now, David, as to how many users are using the system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have about over 100,000 visitors a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
100K a month. Wow, that's tremendous. Now, I can put on my IT hat here because I've been heavily into computers.
That's visitors to the site. I mean, I don't know how many, you know, buy and all that.
Right.
But we have a, you know, big mailing list. And
yeah, well, I'll put on my IT hat, though. I assume you guys have got a pretty powerful server array, lots of storage and plenty of bandwidth for...
Oh, yeah, they're not served from our office. We have a, you know, third-party giant server system
okay.
that does all that. And then the third-party, you know, that runs our networking and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and plus it's complicated because we're delivering these large files.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the downloading system itself, as I'll be saying in my written report. You've got that Java-based system that really does make it easy to purchase an album and then zap all of the files down without the user having to do a whole lot.
I like the Java system too. You know, we could have made it quicker and to do it, but the Java system lets you know how the thing's progressing, what files are complete, and it gives you a tactile feel.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
when you're buying something, you see your product coming in on your computer.
Yeah, I've actually tried some other alternative download sites, and some of them are quicker, but you're right. It puts a lot more burden on the user. The user has to know exactly what they're doing, mm-hmm. which is probably not a smart thing. and you don't have the sense that the HD Tracks interface gives of how you're doing and when it's over and, okay, everything's there now.
Right.
And ready to go.
Right. And also, as soon as you get your first track on HD Track, you can play it while you're waiting for everything else to download.
Yeah.
And read the liner notes.
Yeah, exactly. Now that, and that's a huge plus. Now, so far as you've developed HD Tracks, have you reached the point yet where it's starting to make some money for you, or are you still heading towards break even?
You know, I don't know. It's getting there, you know, but we reinvest all the money.
Right. Okay.
So anything we make, we put right back in our company to grow
it. Okay. No, I mean, that's what I suspected. I mean, as in the first place, as a niche company, it takes some time to get the word out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry is really in its infancy. Apart from iTunes or Amazon stuff that's been out there a few years, the high-end niche for this is still developing. But what I'm saying so far indicates that you guys have a model together that I think is going to work, and so it's just a question of growing it there. Do you see yourself as having much competition in this niche?
I don't know. I mean, I think, first of all, it's a lot of money to start these up and a big headache for a small market. It's like, you know, had we calculated with the VCs before we did this, maybe we wouldn't have done it. But since it's a work of passion, we went ahead and did it anyway, you know. Too late to get out. But I also think, I don't know. I just think for the large companies, it's too small a niche. I mean, these giant companies have to do so much volume to get the needle moving for the stockholders.
Mm-hmm.
I think for smaller companies, it's a very big financial investment and headache.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of the problem behind it is that figuring out the distribution model, since it is a technology-driven approach to these things. We're no longer talking dropping off a pile of LPs for the bins. And so you've got to, I know what IT infrastructure costs, and it's actually an enormous investment. Anybody who thinks that they can just set up a server and make money is dreaming big time.
Well, that's what we thought until we got involved and we needed this and that and this and everything in the world.
Yeah, oh yeah. And well, and then as you start to succeed, you'll have to make it bigger. It's because everybody on the planet's going to be coming to that place.
Well, we can handle a lot of traffic. We've set it up so we can serve this thing out all day long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we can handle that. It's set up for that already. But
I mean, that's kind of like what we did at PFO. I mean, I went through several ISPs as the magazine grew over the years. We found that we kept outgrowing our ISPs, including some fairly well-known names. I finally had to go full. The last time I did it, I said, the heck with this, I'm going to go full industrial. So we went to an industrial-strength ISP who could scale to whatever we needed, period. Even if it was absurd, and that's made a huge difference for us. It's allowed us to move into podcasting and video casting without having to worry about bandwidth and storage.
Right.
Which is a big plus.
Right. But like I said, ours is scalable, and since, you know, our data is hosted in cloud and all that, it can be pulled down anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's already scaled out for that.
Well, let me ask you this question, David. You've mentioned the fact that it's been very challenging to get HD Tracks launched. Now, me, I'm a big fan of Crimes of Passion. I like them a whole lot better than Crimes of Calculation. Let me ask you what you like best about the HD Tracks thing.
I like the fact that I can, first of all, listen to anything I want, any time of the day, shopping-wise. When I go to a record store, I look at a pretty picture and I really don't have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So when I can sample, at least I can get a sense of the recording quality, because mm-hmm. our samples are 320, you know, MP3, mm-hmm. so they're the highest samples there. So you can get a feel if I like the music, so you get to sample the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can sit in my pajamas and buy it,
mm-hmm.
and go to sleep, and what if I want to do, and wake up and it's there in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, I have a better sounding digital file than I bought a CD or a physical disc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's not easy to argue with any of those things. Obviously, iTunes has sort of pointed to this and made it really, really clear that the modern music consumer is very much interested in convenience, portability, instant gratification, being able to sample and then buy. I think that the iTunes model of buying a single cut at 99 cents or here's a package deal appealed to a lot of people. And when you take the fact that people have become comfortable with that and then go to the audiophile niche market and say, okay, so let's take those concepts and do quality too. I think that within that niche, frankly, I think an awful lot of music distribution within high-end is going to move in that direction as well. I wish that SACD would download. Technically, you can download a DSD file. The problem is that locally, there's not much of a way to play it back.
But it's very complicated.
Yeah,
the web is kind of... It's such a new thing, my feeling, is why topple the apple cart before we even get it rolling.
Exactly. No, I think that I think the direction you're moving... 9624 is a nice compromise between quality and file size. Some of our readers may not understand this, but of course as you increase the quantization and as you increase the D word size, the files get really big really fast. Somebody might say, well gee, let's just go straight to 192.24, and then I have to say, you know, friend, you wouldn't believe how big a download that is.
Yeah, those are big. We sell our 192.24 disc on DVDs, but
right.
You know, those files are about 4 or 5 gigs for an album,
mm-hmm.
compared to 1.5 gigs for a FLAC file.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the FLACs are sounding tremendous. I wish that Microsoft would and Apple both would get off their tutus and support FLAC, but obviously they've got their own agendas there.
But you know, there's a lot of small companies coming out, high-end companies that are going to support FLAC.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see a lot of CD-less CD players.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see a lot of things coming out in a few months that support USB sticks.
Right.
High-end market's going there.
Oh yeah, exactly. And heck, I picked up a copy of the Beatles reissue on that USB Apple,
mm-hmm.
and it absolutely sounds brilliant. Those are they give you two sets of files. One's MP3, but the other was FLAC.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you download Winamp, and for our readers, that's WINAMP, you can Google that up. But if you go and check out Winamp, download that, install it, free, boy, those FLAC files come right up.
Mm-hmm.
And they sound brilliant. They really do. So whether I'm listening to Getziberto or the Beatles, the FLAC really doesn't make it sound like your stereotypical digital. Sounds great. Really does sound good. I've asked you what you like best about HG Tracks. Tell me, David, what do you like least?
I don't know. Well, least is dealing with the programmers every day and fixing this, and what can we do to make it better? I mean, it's a 24-hour day. You have to be babysitted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
Well, I guess that's probably true of any business, too.
Yeah, and it's the bureaucracy, and it's the getting the labels, the content is on time, and everything's behind.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's behind. You know, it's just that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's sort of like I love to write symphonies, but getting them done is a pain. It's such a pain that it kind of makes it a drag.
Well, last question for you here. I'm really enjoying our conversation. We can go all day, but I want to respect your time and mine. Let me ask you about the future of the music biz. You've obviously been in it at all levels for your adult life. We're seeing a huge sea change in the music biz now when it comes to how in the world do you distribute music. What's your take on the future? What's the future going to look like as far as you're concerned?
That's a good question. I don't know. I just hope that there's enough of a customer base that pays for music so people will write and perform music. I mean, this is a problem. You know, I mean, this is a job and they have to support families. I know the superstars do well, but, you know, all those middle and lower acts need those 5 and 10,000 unit sales to have a nice little career to do okay. Otherwise, it'll be like the majors. you'll have a few giant artists, and everybody else will say, you know, I'll be a doctor, I'll be a lawyer. We need to have a reason for artists to be artists.
Exactly. Yeah, patronage has always been a huge question. It used to be the emperors and the kings and the archdukes. Nowadays, it's really the common mass of the people in the 20th and 21st
right.
century. And it's via audio. Audio really liberated music from the thrall of aristocrats and the wealthy. And that's been a fascinating social transformation, a cultural transformation there. But
right.
which is why I guess Napster and other bootleg sites and so forth were viewed as such an immense threat by the music biz when they first launched, maybe back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And that's led to a great deal of atomization. I mean, the combination of multiple formats, I mean, the formats all over the place, computer-based playback, variations of optical-based playback, plus the breakdown of the distribution system. I mean, you know, where's Tower Records? Where are all the places, the stores, the shops that people
Right.
used to go are morphing out onto the internet, basically. Even if you're selling physical media, you're selling an awful lot of it the way Chad does. That's right over
Hi.
From your website. Do you see that as being where we're going to end up?
I mean, probably. Look, I live in New York City, and if I have to buy a CD, it's hard to find.
So, I would agree with you. I think the internet's going to be where, even if we have physical media, you will go to the internet to get it. You'll order it in. Heck, yeah, I buy stuff from Chad all the time that way. Impulse buys are pretty easy too, because even if it's optical, I can have it in 2 days.
Sure.
And so that's very cool. I've had some friends in the music industry who they'll say that from an insider standpoint, there's an awful lot of fear and dread out amongst various music companies, music labels. They're not really sure about how to do things in the future. Is that your take on where a lot of them are? They're in touch with the labels.
Well, that's true, but look, it's very simple. It was a transition period. Things will figure out, you know, the people will figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be like Montmartre, France. You go to Montmartre, France, you see 500 artists in a square painting. You go up to a guy, and all of a sudden he puts the paintbrush down, and he starts talking to you about selling the painting. And instead of seeing like a few giant labels, I think you'll see more artist-driven labels, and all the artists would, via the internet will be selling their own products.
Well, that's what actually is causing, I think, a lot of the fear is once the artists are truly independent, or once, if a label exists, it's artist-driven, or it's driven by passion and not by calculation. I actually think that's a good thing myself. Audiophile labels have always been crimes of passion. Always.
The entire audio industry. You know, the one thing I respect about the audio industry, it's an arts and crafts industry. Nobody walks around saying, you know, I'm the richest, I got the most money. Everybody wants to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about passion, and it's the only thing we have in this country where people, you know, give everything to build the highest quality products, not for profit, but for love.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
They're artists. I look at all these guys that run these companies as artists. That's all they are, is artisans.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, frankly, a shift to the more personal, the artisanal, I think is nothing but a gain culturally myself. I think it's a movement away from industrialization and towards the personal, towards the hands-on, towards the passionate connection with music. And I think, I mean, that's something I think is a God-given. I think it's why we have, it's why music speaks to us the way it does. And when we turn it into simply a product, I think it loses its ability to change people's lives. So I'm with you completely on that one. Couldn't agree more. So what we would say then is the future of high-end music distribution is going to head in this direction, I think, pretty clearly. I think we'll still have LPs. There's still a market for vinyl and specialty products. But I think a huge chunk of the future of audiophile music is going to be found right where you guys are taking it. And so I think that it's a brilliant future for us. Really do. I think we're going to go through some confusing white water until we get there. Yeah, so, well, David, I really appreciate I appreciate you taking the time. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our readers?
Well, I don't know. I just enjoy the music. That's what it's about. Enjoy your hi-fi, go to concerts, support musicians, and, you know, it's whatever they enjoy.
Great. Well, for our readers, if you want to check out the site, you can find HD Tracks over at www.hdtracks.com. That's www.hdtracks.com. I recommend it enthusiastically. It's a tremendous site, great music, and I couldn't be any more pleased with the fact that you guys are the ones who have really established a download site that speaks to those of us who love music and love quality, David. Thanks
great.
Very much for all your efforts, okay?
All right. Thanks so much, and have a great day.
Hey, the same to you. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.